So thank you very much for the chance to speak here to you today. I actually came to Perimeter. Can I answer it? Okay. So I actually came to Perimeter three times in 2005, but I haven't been back since. So thank you very much for the opportunity. So today I'll be telling you about some tools that I've been working on to perform effective field theory in inflationary backgrounds. And this work is in collaboration with especially Konrad Schaum, or as I've learned to pronounce, Konrad Schaum, and also with Baumann-Mirberg and van der Char. Now, I certainly don't need to tell this audience how successful inflation is. I'm sure most of you are very well acquainted with all the successes over the past few years of using inflation to describe the very early universe. And even though it is very successful in describing things, we actually can't claim complete success until we derive inflation from a more fundamental theory. And so that's what I'll be describing today. Now, usually, when we start with a fundamental theory and we want to kind of test it against experiment, what we do is we take this fundamental theory and we construct the effective field theory. That is, we integrate out the high energy degrees of freedom, which we can't observe anyway, to produce a low energy effective description, which we can directly compare against experiment. And the way that we do this has been known for quite some time. It's the so-called Wilsonian approach of removing the high energy modes and producing the low energy description. And this technique works extremely well. Unfortunately, it relies upon energy conservation. And this is the one thing we can't assume in an inflationary background. So this means all of the standard techniques really can't work. Okay, well, which part?
Injection in the sense that it's if you narrowly define effective field theory to be this physics in the vacuum, which would be the static thing, then what you said is right. But there is a mild generalization which looks at time-dependent backgrounds, and normally not in cosmology, but in others.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. It's just how to generalize it to time-dependent backgrounds.
Right. And so as long as you're adiabatic, basically, then you don't have level crossing and things like that. That's...
But if you add the UV scale where you do the normalization, somehow you are not supposed to feel the curved space. You're supposed to not see any difference with respect to the flat mark.
That's certainly true. So if you perform some cutoff at the Planck scale, for example, of course, this cutoff would be oblivious to curvature on distances much larger than that. But that doesn't mean that if you have some intermediate scale, that won't be affected. So as I'll show you, it actually is very different from doing effective field theory in static space-time. But we can still make sense of it. Now, this is particularly well-motivated right now because we're getting such an influx of precision cosmology data. And so this really is the key time to understand theoretically what's going on. And so today I'll be telling you about exactly why cosmology is such a unique opportunity, in particular about the modified vacua, how this applies to power spectrum oscillations, non-Gaussianity, and then I'll say a few words about CMB polarization and tensor modes. Now, I think it was Brandenburger who first specifically applied the unique opportunity of cosmology to inflationary backgrounds. Now, normally, if you start at low energy, you stay at low energy. This is just because in static space-time, energy is, of course, conserved. But it was Brandenburger who pointed out that this really isn't true in inflation, because even though we're observing, so I'm sure you've seen this diagram many times before, so this rainbow line here illustrates the redshifting of fluctuations. So this is one mode of co-moving momentum K, what we're doing is we observe this momentum at very large scales today, which means very low energy. But it didn't start out at low energy. It actually started out at very high energy, and it was only because of the expansion of the universe that eventually it became low energy. So we're probing it today at low energy, but it should be sensitive, in principle, to very high energy physics. This is going to be a very long
time. I have a bone to pick with Robert because I think that he. So we've had this conversation many times.
Yes.
he and I, and so there's two things. One is that this issue is not a cosmology issue, right? He often says that somehow that this would be a failure of decoupling in cosmology at some level is the way he would sell it. Which, if it were true, wouldn't be an opportunity. It would be a disaster, right? Because that would mean that there's a huge theoretical error in everything you do.
Yes.
And so you can't calculate it.
But it is a huge, it could be a small theoretical
error. Because you can't quantify it, right? It's if you can't quantify it, it's huge.
So I will tell you how to quantify it, and you're exactly right about disaster versus opportunity. In fact, that was, yeah.
An opportunity.
So that means that, for instance, any evidence you thought you had for inflation is wrong because you have no way of calculating what's going on in inflation. But it's worse than that because anything you thought you understood in this room is wrong because it's nothing to do with cosmology. And so the thing is, it's a time-dependent problem. And so Robert's issue, if I have a magnetic field and I turn it off, then all the Landau levels are there, and as they all collapse, so they turn the magnetic field off. And so the ones that were coming down to very slow energies at the very end came in from infinity at some level. And so all these issues are there, and the magnetic field being turned off. And so if transplanking physics was in the interface there, then every time I turn a magnetic field off, I should be seeing transplanking physics, and I don't. And so and his fallacy is that the assumption that goes into time-dependent field theory, effective field theory, is the adiabatic approximation. If you violate that, which is what all the examples that he chooses, and you can make it less radical ones that do that, then you can invalidate the effective field theory limit. But if you don't invalidate that, and you don't, and there's no evidence that transplanking physics does.
Good. So first, we're actually trying to get away from the term transplanking, because this was the term coined by Vandenberger, because he really pushed the idea to its extreme, exactly as you said, that all low-energy physics should, in principle, be sensitive to very high-energy physics, and the extreme example being the Planck scale or beyond. So even though we didn't know anything about the details, of course, people were trying to estimate the order of magnitude of these effects, just as you say. And so there's really only two energy scales involved. There's a scale H of inflation and the scale M of new physics. And so any operator that we measure at low energies would parametrically have to go something like H over M, but to some exponent. And that exponent wasn't really known, and some of you in the audience probably are aware there was a controversy in the literature about 10 years ago. Yeah.
You're objecting to the fact that there was a controversy?
No, but it just you're phrasing it as if we're only arguing about the power of H over M. And so there's a fourth paper, which is not on your list, but it's a classic written by somebody in this room. Which points out that for instance, if you had inflation, you had a potential energy that gave you H, and that's another scale. And so you can get powers of that divided by M.
Wait, but potential gives you H, which...
No, potential gives you some scale, say mu, and then H is mu squared over M Planck. So there's,
that's true. I'm not including M Planck in here just because I'm trying to estimate the order of magnitude of the new physics.
But you're assuming it's H in the numerator, which is not necessarily true, right? It could be.
Well, if it was M Planck, then that would be kind of.
No, then this could be the scale mu. It could be the gut scale, say, in effective field theory for.
That's true, but that would mean that. Yeah, that would mean that all pressure for order one, which is why
interesting, right?
That's true. No, this is I guess this is sort of the safe estimate that the corrections were there, but small. We can kind of interpretively analyze them.
Well, you're choosing to focus on a class of them, which are not necessarily the biggest ones. And then this paper that you didn't cite goes through and shows that the things that you do get tend to be things that are not observable. So it's not effectively a problem for the things you're going to want to do, probably, but it's. I had to do
it. I will definitely have a look at this fourth paper. Who was the author?
Some losers.
Okay. So, in an attempt to answer some of these questions, there are actually three, possibly four, different approaches. So, one approach was a so-called new physics hypersurface approach, in which at some scale m, new physics was sort of artificially added. And this is very physical because this is sort of in line with our intuition that new physics kicks in at some large energy scale, but it's really unfamiliar to us because it wasn't in the context of effective field theory. And conversely, there was the boundary effective field theory, which introduces new physics at some moment, at one slice in time, which does allow you to use effective field theory, but it actually doesn't. It does assume energy conservation, which is simply not present in inflation. So it's not very physical. And finally, there's an approach by Weinberg, Senatore, and Zeldarriaga, which they simply write down all the possible effective terms that could be present at low energy and analyze it from there. But unfortunately, this actually, it doesn't begin with a fundamental theory. So there's no way of making contact with some UV complete theory such as quantum gravity. And so what we're telling you today is about another technique, which actually we believe has all the advantages of these previous approaches, but none of the disadvantages. Yes?
Weinberg in some sense can accommodate a new scale of the type you want to include. So
he writes out all of like the higher dimensional
for the implicon itself.
Yes.
So he has some scale m that controls. So I would have thought that does incorporate some of what you want to do. It's not the Planck scale, but it's higher energy.
No, it's absolutely true what he does. It could be an effective description, but there's no way that you could ever make contact with the fundamental theory because.
What do you mean by fundamental?
So what we're going to do is we're going to start with some UV complete theory. So we know what it is to arbitrarily high energy. So like a very simple Planck model, and then we'll construct the low energy effect.
You mean
description.
Super Planckian?
Yes. So that's exactly. So yeah. So in this approach, you can't go the other way. And also, I might add, these approaches by Weinberg, Sinclair, and Zaldarriaga, they actually assume a specific choice of vacuum, the Bunch Davies vacuum, and we show that it actually shouldn't be assumed. So most of what we'll be talking about for the first part of the talk actually has to do with the power spectrum. And this is something that many of you are probably familiar with. This is really just the power spectrum of the inflationary perturbations. And this is a very well-measured observable. WMAP, in particular, has measured it to a few decimal places. And intuitively, you can actually think of it as just a two-point function. And that's not precisely right, but for now, you can kind of intuitively think of it like that. And it's very easy to understand why this includes new physics. So if you simply think of this sort of in terms of the Feynman diagram language, it's very easy to see that loop corrections or interactions with heavy fields would include any such new physics in the power spectrum.
Now, without going into any detailed models right now, it's easy to see it's useful to write down sort of all the possible effective descriptions for what the power spectrum could be. So let's just write down what the two-point function action could be. And so we have the usual kinetic term, and then we have the term from the inflating background, and then we have sort of the higher corrections from high energy interactions. And these are done as a Taylor series relative to low energy. And it's very important to realize that in this usual expansion, we're trying to preserve Lorentz invariance. This is the usual approach done in static space-time. And so derivatives have to come in pairs, of course, because we need two of them to maintain Lorentz invariance. And the derivatives are Fourier transformed through momentum, so we're always getting p squared over m squared. So it's very important that it's always squared in there. And this means that any correction to the power spectrum will have to go as h over m squared, because this is after freeze-out, and so p is on the order of h. But this is absolutely disastrous for hoping to measure any corrections to the inflationary power spectrum, because h over m optimistically is only about 0.01, and we're squaring that, as I mentioned. So if this was the end of the story, there would really be no chance of ever being able to observe high energy corrections to the power spectrum. Fortunately, this is not the case. There's actually a loophole in what I just said, and the loophole is, of course, we don't need to preserve Lorentz invariance because the inflating background already breaks it, so why would we try to preserve this in our effective description? So given that time is special, we can actually go ahead and write down sort of a boundary term so we can localize effective terms at one moment in time. So normally we can't do this, of course, in the static space-time, but here we can. And simple dimensional analysis tells you that these localized terms would have one power of energy larger than the other corrections, and so we would expect that such corrections should go as h over m. Now you might wonder, well, what is the physical meaning of these terms? Because they're not really interactions in the usual sense, but it's actually very easy to understand in the context of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So remember that adding a localized potential in quantum mechanics sort of requires you to apply these boundary matching conditions across this boundary, this delta function potential. And so whatever solution that you have at one side will determine what you have on the other side, subject to some matching conditions. And so as I'll show you later, what it really amounts to is rotating your vacuum. Now this is actually much easier to understand in the Hamiltonian viewpoint, because here we actually have states, not boundary conditions. Now the usual vacuum condition is the so-called Bunch-Davies vacuum condition, which is really just amounting say that we have this condition, sort of that the vacuum is empty. Now, in static space-time, this is uniquely what the vacuum condition is. It says that we're in the state of lowest energy. But in a cosmological background with an expanding space-time, we don't necessarily have to make this choice. In fact, we can relax a little bit, and we can say that this is a more general condition, and so it's still linear, but we've rotated it away from the Bunch-Davies vacuum by a small amount beta. And beta can depend upon k. So we can kind of rotate each vacuum for k a little bit differently. And the solution to this is very easy to write down. It's a squeezed coherent state. And so intuitively, you can think of it as just a little bit excited. So it's an excited state of order beta. Now, if you were to consider such a vacuum, it's actually very easy to understand. Yes?
Only consider a squeezed coherent state, not just some any general.
It's not just any state, so it's specifically this because this is a linear condition.
Okay, so why do you want linear condition?
Well, kind of in the simplest. So this would be the condition for a non-interacting theory. We each field evolves separately, mm-hmm. So we would just say that this is the vacuum condition for this mode of moving k. So.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand, because I mean, suppose if this is due to some cutoff effect, then it would be non-linear thing, so non-linear effect.
So that's exactly the hope, is that when you kind of integrate out all this non-linear interaction stuff, high energy, that the effective description will have some sort of simple condition, mm-hmm. and it will just effectively amount to a rotation for each mode separately. And it will, yeah.
Same principle, that can be generalized.
So I could certainly write down some other nonlinear terms, but then it gets very complicated. The simplest thing to do is just say, what is the vacuum?
This is that something of Gaussianity in something, isn't it?
Right, because if it's a Gaussian description, of course, each one is decoupled. It's just free theory.
Yeah, isn't that what essentially you're just solving here for the free
propagator? Exactly, so each one is equal to the other, so that's why it's linear.
And the interacting state, is not in this form.
Exactly, yeah. So it's very easy to see what the observable effect these modified vacua is. You simply evaluate the power spectrum in these modified vacua. You see that what you get is, you get the Bunch-Davies power spectrum from the unmodified solutions, but it's modulated by this oscillating term. And this oscillating term has magnitude beta. And so, of course, this means that your power spectrum will kind of have the overall shape that it would have before, but it has the sinusoidal pattern with amplitude beta. Now, I'm not claiming that having this ringing pattern necessarily implies that you have modified vacuum in your theory. In fact, there are a few counterexamples in theory, most notably this axion monodromy model, Silverstein-Westphal. But it does seem to be true that theories with modified vacuum do give you these oscillations.
Is that if you just modify, if you just turn on one of those betas of k and leave all the other ones off, you get a sinus effect, right?
Right. So there's kind of a condition here. This is for if beta is very close to being scale invariant.
So if you allow yourself freedom to turn them all on, you can just get any.
So you could do anything, of course, if you just picked each one separately. But observationally, we found that inflation gives you an almost scale invariant spectrum, and so consistent with that, if the vacuum modifications are almost scale invariant, that's what gives you these oscillations. So because there do seem to be kind of a. At some point, they would have to turn off because otherwise you have an infinite amount of energy, of course. So this was this alpha vacua. At some point, yeah, but for all observable k's, this is what you would have.
Means beyond some k?
Beyond some k, exactly. So as I'll describe later, so what we're really doing is we're starting at some very high energy theory, and we're looking at the low energy description. So the low energy description will have these modified vacua, but that's really just kind of representing this unknown high energy physics. So if you want to keep going to arbitrarily high energy, you shouldn't be using the effective field theory description.
The high energy part was you had some time thing was very fast, so that was your sudden approximation, your delta function.
I actually haven't said anything yet about how to produce this. I've just said, if you were to consider modified vacua, this is what the effect would be.
we're looking at a delta of time. And I thought we...
Oh, yeah. So I said, yeah, here. These terms are possible to add. I haven't said why you should add them, just
right.
That they are possible, and that one could add them.
And it's believable that kind of thing would give you a coherent state because you've turned on phi squared.
Exactly. So I'll later show why this would naturally appear in your effective action.
But is the picture that whatever this was, it was fast because it was at a particular time?
Yes.
So that's the high energy physics that you're saying is
right. So it will physically appear because it represents the moment at which your system hits the new physics scale, and so it can suddenly interact. I'll show you, actually, with Feynman diagrams, exactly why this appears. There is a good reason why you get such a delta function interaction.
Well, you're gonna actually have the multiplied physics that will give you this interaction.
Exactly. So here I just wanted to show you that you could put it in, and so the philosophy of effective field theory is you should include all possible terms consistent with your symmetries. And so in an explaining background, this is consistent with your symmetry, so you should consider. So because these oscillations do seem to be kind of a generic feature, either of modified vacua or of some of these monodromy models, people have begun to consider these when looking at the inflationary data. And the best analysis I've seen is by Jerome Martin and Christoph Ringewald, who looked at such oscillations in the WMAP3 data. And this was their parameterization in the scalar fluctuations. So it's the usual ansatz, it comes to the slow world parameters, but they allowed for oscillations. So here, these parameters control the amplitude, by the way they parameterized it, and then these parameters in here control the different frequencies. So they looked for all sorts of oscillations, and the result was suggestive, but of course not definitive. WMAP beta simply isn't good enough to be able to discern individual oscillations. And so, graph on the left here, it shows, so these are the different frequencies, and up here on the vertical axis, the different amplitudes. So they did find some resonant frequencies. So there is sort of a hint that some oscillations appear, but of course it could just be fitting to noise. So given that there may actually be a signal, and the data is, of course, expected to be much better with the Planck satellite, it's really important to understand theoretically what this would mean. And so this is what I've been doing with Conrad Schellum. And so to illustrate how we derive these effective field theories, it's probably best to just go through a simple example. So in this example, we begin with a simple inflating system. So this is just single field slow roll. So this is a
completely familiar example to most of you. And we just added a very simple modification to represent new physics. So to the inflaton, we added a heavy field. So it has mass m, and it has a coupling parameterized by this coupling g. So there's two light fields and one heavy field. So that's the interaction with new physics at high scales. So what we're going to do is compute the power spectrum in this system. And now we have to be a little bit more precise about what power spectrum really means. Most of the time in quantum field theory, what you're computing are in-out scattering amplitudes. But that's not what we want to do here. What we want to do here is compute an in-in correlation function. And so what this means is, we start with some states. We're actually going to start with a bunch baby state at very early times. And we're going to evolve that forward, just like normal. And we evaluate the two-point correlation at some late times. Then we de-evolve it back in time. So in an in-out scattering amplitude, we would actually just continue to evolve it to the asymptotic future. But we're not going to do that. So there's no information about the late time dynamics.
No, this is the complete system.
There
might be, but all of the details of the inflating system, we're actually just going to encode in the slow roll parameters.
Well, I'm asking, there is a cubic
basonic field, which is usually...
Chi field is unstable.
It's unstable. There is a runaway direction, right?
Yeah, so we're only looking at the perturbative interactions of the phi with the chi. So I'm not going to consider like a hybrid inflation model. I consider like the full potential.
Start nucleating new bubbles.
Chi is stable because there's a quantum.
If I take phi equals chi direction of some sort, right?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Overwhelm the mass term. It's usual.
No, it's never.
Yes, because it's pi squared chi.
Yeah, no,
so there's a chi squared term there.
So. Yeah, so
pi squared
is
the
border
n,
because
it's
a cubic
order
n.
There's another way there.
Any cubic scalar feels
like cubic can be bounded from below.
I've already told you. I completely agree, but what we're doing is we're only looking at determinative interactions with the heavy field. So we're not looking at like the large field dynamics. So I completely agree that the high potential is unstable. But we're only looking at the interactions of the inflows on the heavy field.
But the rules are the chi's in its vacuum, classical vacuum, and then you're looking
exactly. At the exactly. So as I said, so this is a little bit different from
the usual thing that we calculate in quantum field theory. But to make sense of this, it actually it helps to perform this simple trick. So we can think of this actually as two different sets of fields. So we can think of this as sort of a positive set of fields. This has the usual forward time evolution. And we can think of this as the negative set of fields, which has kind of the reverse direction of time evolution. So what we can do is we can think of this as one system with an action which has a positive action here and with a negative action on this side. So we can just kind of combine the two in this strange way. And when we do this, there's actually a field rotation, which is immediately suggested. So what we do is we just rewrite these positive and negative set of fields in the different linear combination. So we just rotate them. And this results in a combined action for everything, which is much easier. So it has just a usual light field, and it has a heavy field, the same mass, m. And the interaction term is now split into three different components. And so the free field solution is, of course, exactly what you would expect. This is the usual free field solution of a massless field in De Sitter space. And this is the solution of a heavy field, mass m, in De Sitter space. So we're just going to study the interactions of this system. Now, normally what we do is we consider Feynman-Green's functions. But in this rotated system, the Feynman-Green's functions actually get transformed as well. They get transformed into forward and retarded Green's functions, as well as Whiteman functions. So Whiteman functions are something which usually aren't there in quantum field theory that we consider. So you can see I've used positive and dashed lines to represent kind of the two different sets of fields, and I've used single lines to represent the light fields and double lines to represent the heavy fields. And so this interaction term, which got split into three different terms, it's simply represented by this. So we see that there's these different terms.
Keldysh propagator, right?
FK is the Whiteman function of moving momentum K.
Okay. It's called Keldysh propagator, I guess.
Yeah, well, yeah.
The Keldysh propagator is symmetrized. Is this symmetrized or is it just like simple?
When you say symmetrized, what do you mean? It's not a propagator, it's a Whiteman function.
Okay. So it's not the same as Keldysh propagator.
So now that we have these rules, we can just go ahead and write down all the Feynman diagrams, and it turns out there's 8 of them. And so here they are. So these are all the diagrams which contribute from the heavy field interacting to produce corrections in the light field power spectra. Now, it would be a lot of work if we actually tried to sit down and evaluate all of these, because we would like to have some sort of approximation to see which ones are important and to get explicit answers. And we were actually able to develop an extremely useful tool for doing this. And surprisingly, this actually wasn't known in the literature before. So I'll give you a physical interpretation and a mathematical interpretation. So physically, remember the only interaction that we're studying is when two light fields interact with a heavy field. And so if you think about this, so let's say that you start with these two light fields. As the universe expands, the light fields will lose energy and they get redshifted. And there's one moment in time in which they have precisely enough energy to interact with this heavy field. Now, physically, remember, we haven't transformed into energy, into the energy space. We're actually staying in the time domain, which means every time that we have a vertex, we have to integrate over all time. And what we're integrating is over the free field solutions. So when you look at this integral, the free field solutions, of course, look basically like plane waves. So it's basically a plane wave plus kind of polynomial corrections because of the expanding background. And if you look at the phase of these plane wave solutions,
you see that there's a simple rescaling that can be performed, which actually lets you put this in the form of a stationary phase approximation. So you see that the phase actually very sharply oscillates, But at the one moment at which energy is conserved, so this interaction is sort of kinematically allowed, that's when the phases constructively interfere. So what this means is that it sort of mathematically shows you when this interaction will take place, and physically it's easy to understand why. That's the moment at which energy is conserved. And so once you realize that you can perform this sort of Gaussian integral, you can explicitly get this answer to leading order in h over m, because this phase was rescaled by order m over h, a very large number. And so because we can explicitly get this answer, and because we know basically at what moment this interaction takes place, it's very easy to see that actually six of the diagrams are either exactly zero or are zero to leading order in h over m, which is all that we had hoped for anyway. And so it turns out only two of these diagrams will contribute at all. Yeah?
Is this true for all k and all prime? Or is that going to fail?
The WQB approximation?
For the massive amount.
Yes, good. So if I go back here. Yeah. So
when does it fail? I guess.
So it turns out, so you're absolutely right, this is using the WQB approximation. But it's actually valid to leading order in h over n.
For all time.
For all time, yeah. So at worst, it will be, it will have h over m corrections, and it will be better than that.
So you actually get the leading logical result from what was calculated by Moskell and Gross and Epstein.
Yes.
But the quasi-classical calculation was done by Wolowick.
Okay,
it doesn't matter.
What about that?
Okay, and the second, so yeah, if you didn't have the saddle, if you don't have a saddle, like in the other diagrams, do you know roughly what the order, what the diagram is of order?
Yeah, so.
So you're getting square root of h over m?
Exactly. So because this is rescaled by m over h, this means that when you do the integral, if it has a saddle point, you get a square root of h over m. And if you didn't have the stationary phase, you would just have h over m. Exactly. So there's really only two diagrams that we need to explicitly evaluate.
Can you give a hint or a possible simple explanation why those diagrams?
Yes, I absolutely can. So this one, for example. So because, all right, I'll show you. So if you think about, so the k is of course fixed. That's the external moving momentum. And what we're doing is we're doing an integral over this loop momentum q. And it's very easy to see that if you think back here, the time of the interaction, this is determined by the two co-moving momentum of the light fields coming into it, right? So now if you go back to here, you see that the time of this interaction has to be the same as the time of this interaction, just because of the topology of the diagram. This q goes around, right? And so if these are evaluated at the same time, this is a retarded Green's function, which, if you evaluate at the same time, is zero. So all diagrams which have a retarded Green's function in the middle will vanish. And then some of the diagrams, like this one here, it has a forward and a retarded Green's function. So those vanish identically, exactly. This vanishes to leading order in h over n, and these are zero. So, yeah, these have equal times exactly. So exactly zero, exactly zero, exactly zero, leading order. And this one, it turns out, for reasons I can't really go into here, if you have three dashed lines, this actually represents a quantum correction. It's actually kind of a strange feature of the Stringer-Kelvish formalism. Loops do not necessarily imply quantum corrections. Sometimes they represent statistical corrections. And so...
just because one of the Green functions just gives you statistical information, GK, or the Kelvish function gives you statistical information.
What yes.
Retarded and advanced so-called recontributing quantum.
Exactly.
And so you use a spectrum.
So this last correction is a quantum correction, and you can actually show with a little work that it will give you a correction which is subleading in h over n. So that's why we can neglect it. So this was a very useful trick, being able to localize when the interaction takes place, because it allows you to get rid of a lot of these diagrams. And it lets you explicitly write down the answer for the ones that do contribute. Now, this seems a bit strange. how do you impose an energy cutoff in something which doesn't have energy conservation? Because we are still going to do a loop momentum integral. And the way that we do this is we again exploit the fact that we have the stationary phase approximation. So this is, of course, a 3D integral that we're doing over the co-moving momentum q. And we can, of course, just explicitly write that out. So it's really just a 2D integral over the magnitude and direction of q. Now, some of this integral phase space represents different times of interaction, because the time of interaction in the vertex will depend on q. And some of the phase space in little q will, of course, affect the energy. And so it turns out that we can actually just do a transformation into those different bases. So we're transforming the q and the angle of q into the time of interaction and then this, what I call big Q, sort of the orthogonal direction, which is basically the energy. And so once we rotate it into this basis, it actually lets you explicitly see what's happening in this phase space. And this area that I've shown in gray is actually the low energy component of the phase space. So it's all of the integration which is below some energy scale lambda. So you can set lambda to be whatever you want, just your usual UV cutoff, and this shaded component as the low energy part. So,
and by what is it that's left? The thing that's less than lambda is momentum, or
the
part less than lambda.
An integral over what?
So the integral that we're doing is this co-moving momentum q.
Yes, yeah,
so
it's a momentum.
Right?
It's a momentum.
So it's not directly obvious what the low energy component of that is. So usually in a Feynman diagram, when we write down, so we have the integral over the four momentum, you can immediately see, this is the high energy part, and this is the low energy part. We just slice the integral into low and high energy parts. But it's not so obvious here. Like,
why? So the thing, so the classical background is just the phi doing some slow roll, and then chi sitting somewhere.
Yes.
So it's a perfectly adiabatic problem. So why can't I, you know, for instance, to your title slide, I mean, why can't I identify energy using the adiabatic energy states? And then why is it fundamentally different than it would have been if it had been a time-independent case?
How do you identify energy?
Because normally the assertion of an effective field theory in a time-dependent context would be that the equations of the effective field theory capture the full physics only in the adiabatic approximation. And in that approximation, all your energy levels are kind of parametrically depending on time, but you're not having any levels cross or anything. And you can kind of see why that has to be true, because if what you're basically doing in effective field theory is you're excluding states of high energy. Mm-hmm. And so the kinds of things that will make that screw up will be if you have enough energy in your background to jump to a forbidden state, or if you have energy levels crossing so that your gap is going away.
Are you saying, Cliff, that you can cut, like, your cutoff will be floating as well? Like, changing?
It could be, yeah. So that's a dangerous thing, because if you have an energy level crossing, then what you thought was a high energy scale could become a low one, and then there's no longer a good approximation to get rid of those things.
I'm confused why you think there's a hierarchy.
The effective field theory assumes there's a hierarchy, right?
Well, but we found, what I mean is that
dependence is slow.
It is. It's a smooth, it's a smooth transition. It's kind of where you want to put lambda, but you will always have these corrections from the high energy field, the heavy field.
No, at what energy scale
lambda?
Oh yeah, right. But that's set by your mass or whatever the heavy thing was, right?
Exactly.
But because some of these are virtual effects. You will still, even if you are at low energy, you will actually still have like virtual corrections from this heavy field. And so
the mass, but you're tracking the cutoff.
There's also a cutoff, yes.
But the thing is that fourth objection is that the one thing you know about the cutoff is that that's not in the answer, because the cutoff is kind of how you're organizing your calculation. So once you normalize things, you're going to remove the cutoff. So
absolutely.
So normally the thing that would control an effective field theory calculation would be some physical mass ratio of some sort, which in your case I thought was going to be 1 over m.
Absolutely. So in this, in the work that we've done so far, we actually just explicitly put in a UV cutoff. In the work that we're doing right now, we're studying the renormalization. So what we did right now, we'll have an explicit cutoff.
But do I think that, so just to follow the rest of your talk, should I be thinking that there's two parameters that are large, m and lambda, or
yes.
Just m is lambda?
Yes, that's exactly right.
But then, so then I worry about lambda, because I can understand why m is large, that's some physical thing, but what lambda has no physical significance, so why do I care if it's large or not?
It doesn't have physical significance. Well, you can see that it actually forces lambda to be above m, because if the new physics only sort of kicks in virtually at scale m, and of course, your cutoff will need to be above that. Right now, lambda doesn't have any direct physical significance, but because it is large, we estimate it to be of order m.
Well, so at the end of the day...
At the end of the day, I'll give you an expression which does depend on lambda.
Oh, it does depend on lambda.
It does depend on lambda. Right now, our next work will be about the renormalization. And so how to get rid of that, exactly as you say, it will probably depend upon ratios of masses and such.
So just to make sure, is this lambda in this formula is just the cost cutoff?
Yeah, it's just the energy cutoff. So we do put in this cutoff, and so we can explicitly give you these corrections. So the corrections to the scalar power spectrum, from this diagram, you see that, so it depends upon lambda and also m, and then we can explicitly get all these slow roll corrections. So this is an almost scale invariant answer. If you set the epsilons to zero, of course, you would just get some basic result. So it sort of enhances the power spectrum by a fixed amount at all scales.
So this is dead up to zeta, right?
Yeah, this is the correction.
Okay.
So yeah, so you see it has a coupling out front. So if you just turn off interactions, it goes away.
So this is kind of a boring result from this first diagram. It's just sort of an overall enhancement from interactions. The second diagram is much more interesting. So what we see is we actually get a result which, again, depends on lambda and m by some amount here, but it actually has a sinusoidal pattern. So this is exactly kind of the effect that we were looking for, but it's automatically induced, and it's very easy to understand why.
So we see that the two external light fields that we're actually correlating, so they interact directly with this heavy field here. And so in contrast, of course, the heavy field is really only sort of virtually involved. So we're performing this loop integral, so it's sort of smeared across all scales, whereas here, the heavy field actually kicks in as soon as the light fields are blue-shifted enough to have enough energy at some point back in time. So it's a very sudden physical interaction. So it kicks in at one moment in time, it's non-adiabatic, and so that's why we get this oscillating pattern.
So your answers are so strongly dependent on your cutoff that it's very hard to think that there's anything else other than the cutoff thing.
Yes, so we haven't explicitly included this cutoff. At this point, we just have no choice. So we're studying the renormalization issues later. But there it is. It does depend upon the cutoff.
You didn't tell us how you put your cutoff in?
So when we have these diagrams, so we can turn this integral over the co-moving momentum, q, with a simple change of basis, we can see this allows us to kind of localize what part of the phase space is low energy and what part is high energy. Exactly. So this was actually a mistake that we made early on. What we did originally, about a year ago, we just put a simple cutoff in the co-moving momentum q, because that's sort of quasi-disintegracy. So that's the natural variable, because that's what's conserved, and so that's what we just simply cut off. We didn't realize what we really do have to cut off is the physical momentum, and so we have to kind of rotate this basis. So we have to move away from little q into this basis, which is sort of a physical energy parameter and the time of interaction. And when we do that, we can actually explicitly identify which part of the phase space corresponds to low physical energy. Yeah?
I just don't quite understand what's going on. If lambda is much greater than m,
yes.
Than h, then the renormalization should go as in flat space. The real issue
just because at these scales you don't feel the difference between flat and curved space. Real issues will become will appear in the following situation: that you have some theory with some big mass and small mass. You integrate out big mass guys, but it might happen that due to the expansion, you may feel the modes which were at the time when the size of the horizon was exactly 1 over m of the mass you integrated out. So maybe you better like impose the cutoff in this way. Like you, I mean, I didn't follow all the details in what you were saying, but probably like, I mean, don't you have to like look at the, I mean, this m, big m.
Yes.
If you integrate out the big m and look for effective theory for the fields with lower mass, m should be a cutoff, and the whole issue should be there, like in studying how m appears in the answers and how you can
I completely agree that if all the calculations that we were doing were quantum field theory at very high energy scales, much greater than the curvature scale, then we should just recover the flat space limit. But the difference is that what we're doing is we're observing the power spectrum at very late times, and so there's sort of this mix-up of energy scales, and so it's not quite that simple. And so that's why we've tried to be very careful to look and pay attention at when is it low energy and when is it high energy. And so that's why in this loop diagram we see that it's not a simple answer. Part of the phase space is low energy and part is not.
What I'm saying, I would impose a cutoff not by like cutting your lambda, but by importing an extra field with high enough mass.
You mean like a polyvalars?
And integrate it out.
Like a polyvalars.
See how, huh?
Polyvalars.
Okay.
You add an extra field of some really large mass and then just sort of...
And then see how this mass appears in your...
That is actually exactly what we're doing next for the renormalization. So we certainly know that there are drawbacks with an explicit cutoff, but what we're trying to do here is simply show that you can start with some fundamental theory and go all the way through and get some low energy theory.
In fact, in condensed matter, they do similar stuff in time-dependent backgrounds. In time-dependent.
Yeah, no, I completely agree that would be the best way to do it, but there are subtleties that we haven't figured out. So here we've just had to use a crude sharp cutoff.
But have you looked at the terms which are not like either logarithmically divergent or finite? Because at least the logarithmically divergent, we could trust it would stay, the magnitude would stay roughly the same. Because these ones could as well go to zero once you renormalize.
They could, except physically they do represent something. So I would be surprised if they simply went away.
An example, a famous example is if you took quantum electrodynamics and you cut it off, then your photon mass will be enormous. It'll get some cutoff dependent photon mass, and you know that that's going to get renormalized away to zero. But that's an example where the whole thing was zero when you were fooled by having a big, looked like a big term.
Yeah, no, I don't have any other answer except to say that what we've done so far is that we just had to put a sharp cutoff in. And so we hope that with renormalization we can be more sophisticated about which things
but even with
stay there and go away.
Yeah, but even with a sharp cutoff you'll have finite terms. Are they just way, way
smaller? No, well, these were the leading terms with our sharp cutoff. So this is all we could do right now.
One of the things that happens, I've done calculations like this too, and a danger in these kinds of is you have to be very careful how you do the cutoff. For instance, do you cut off every single line is not allowed to have a momentum bigger than lambda, or do you just have some integral at the end of the day which you say is cut off at lambda?
Good. So remember, the interaction that takes place is localized at one moment in time, and so because you can kind of estimate the energy, so the energy of some mode is going to be h times tau, so the co-moving time, times the co-moving momentum k, or q, is appropriate. So that means that you can estimate the energy of the mode sort of at the time of interaction. And so we only allow up to physical energy scales of lambda.
The one thing that you should check is, and this is something which surprised me when I first saw it, is that if you start just cutting off integrals like that, and if you route the momentum differently through the graph, then you'll get a completely different answer. The numerical coefficient in front of your dominant cutoff can be different, which just emphasizes
that. Root them differently?
Supposing instead of having q in the top of the line and q plus k in the bottom, you have q plus k over 2 in the top of the line and q minus k over 2 in the bottom line or something like that. Then you cut off q again, you can get a different numerical coefficient.
Oh, of course, but that's precisely why we didn't. That's why we're not doing a cutoff in little cube. We're doing a cutoff in the physical energy scale. So there's nothing in this diagram which will have physical energy greater than lambda.
Further, the only way to avoid that problem is to have every single line you modify the propagator so that it's each propagator saturates at some scale. And it's not you don't get to choose an integral at some point and cut it off. I don't know if you did that. Maybe you did that.
This exact thing we were very careful about because we didn't do it correctly a year ago, and then we realized it's actually the physical energy cutoff. So I'm pretty sure we did this carefully. Now.
Why don't we let one last question?
Sorry for bugging you. One last question. Just to understand. Do I correctly understand that you cut the integral over the tau? That's how you implement the cutoff.
Cut the integral
over the tau. Is that like
over the tau?
Yeah. Is that how you make the physical cutoff?
No. So the tau just corresponds to the time of interaction.
Yeah.
So we don't care what time it interacts. We perform the cutoff in the energy scale.
Do you cut the Q or tau? Like and then.
We cut off the Q, but that actually automatically imposes the cutoff in the taus. So you can see here that so this black line here, so this involves the energy scales, and then this is just a mathematical constraint because you can't have 1 minus cosine theta b.
The reason why I was asking about cutting tau because that you, this way you basically forbid to create those modes at the moment of tau, you create the modes of energy.
Absolutely, it automatically does that. So when you look at this phase place diagram, when you look at this area, you just see that it automatically puts kind of constraints on tau. So we have two diagrams, and they produce two corrections, and this is the result since it's corrected power effect. Now, so there are several things that we wish to advance on this. So first, of course, we hope to look for these oscillations in the WMAP data. And for this, of course, we're using the analysis by Jerome Martin and Christoph Ringewald, they said, who had already done this for WMAP, but with the help of Don Nierberg, a very bright grad student in Amsterdam, we're trying to improve it a little bit. And then also we're working with Ted van der Alst, a grad student on the theoretical analysis, and in particular, the renormalization analysis. So here's a preliminary plot, just to show you that we've been looking for these oscillations. So this is the search for oscillations in the WMAP 7 data. And so on the horizontal axis, again, are the different frequencies, and on the vertical axis, the different likelihoods. And you see right now, it just looks like noise, because this is kind of what you would expect in the WMAP data. And there's sort of an overall enhancement at higher frequencies, but this just means that you can always kind of get a better fit to noise at higher frequencies. So we are actively working on this. Now, just to verify, the result should be very nearly scale invariant, because we didn't put in any explicit k dependence, and so it's good that we recovered this. And just as a quick check, you can see that the energy scale at all the times of interaction, so all of these stationary phase localized time of interactions, are exactly the same. So it kicks in at scale m, scale of new physics. And remember, because this is a stationary phase approximation with a Gaussian fluctuation in the time of interaction, even that is verified to be scale invariant. So that's good. So all components of these new physics are scale invariant. Now, going back to some things that I said in the very beginning, there was this controversy about h over m. And so some groups said it should be h over m to the power 1, some to the power 2. And we found actually that it's neither. It's actually to the 3/2. And this seems like kind of a funny compromise. But how does this fit in the context of the previous arguments? Remember when we had this effective action expansion in terms of low energy, we actually assumed implicitly that these were all local operators. And this is usually fine because when we do a low energy expansion in static space-time, what we're really doing is, if we have some Green function for a heavy field, so it's exactly this, but we can expand this out in terms of low energy relative to the mass m, and we see that at first, the first term, low energy, it's really just the delta function. So it localizes interactions at one place, and you can get kind of derivative corrections on top of that. So this is for a static space-time expansion. But as we see here, the effective description, so integrating out the high energy fields, so it gives you these Green functions of heavy fields, but but in an expanding background. And it's actually completely different because what happens is that at low energy, these heavy fields don't actually have a delta function approximation. So they actually don't localize the interactions to one point in space-time. And the way that you can see this is, so these physically represent these interactions. So this is the action integrating out the heavy fields. And we can take these light fields and just Fourier expand them. So even though energy is not conserved, they'll have some Fourier expansion. And using these...
Sorry, are you saying about some particular green function which behaves like that? Because like...
The heavy field chi that we're integrating out.
If you take two space-time points lying on the same, at the same point, you say that it doesn't behave like a delta function of x.
Right. So if this was a diagram in static space-time, mm-hmm. and I wanted to know what the low energy description of this was, I would just say, this heavy field propagator, it actually just gets shrunk down to one point. So this interaction is like a quartic interaction of the light field at one point in space-time, right? But as I'll show you right here, in an expanding background, that's not true, because you can take these light fields and you slice them open, the Fourier expansion, and again, you have these sort of vertex-type integrals over time, and again, you can have the stationary phase approximation, so you can write down the answer to leading order in h over m, and so you'll get some answer using this approximation. But what happens is that, remember that the time of interaction, it depends upon the co-moving momentum here, so k1 and k2. And that won't necessarily be the same k1 and k2 over here. So it has to be conserved. What comes in has to come out. But the relative distribution will be different. And so this will interact at one time, and this will interact at another time. And they probably won't be the same times. So this cannot be shrunk to one point in space-time. They will interact different.
Even if the thing you integrated out was very massive compared to the Hubble scale.
Yes.
So in particular, in this room, if we're in de Sitter space, because of the dark energy you're saying...
It's like an h over m thing, so that's why if m was absolutely huge, then the difference wouldn't be much.
But what's x the scale of non-locality?
The h over m. So that's why if m was huge, then it would be very, very small. But there is a difference.
But normally the statement would have been that the m sets the scale, 1 over m is kind of setting the scale of the distance that the two vertices could be apart from one another, but you're saying that it's longer than that, I understand, right?
Yeah, because...
How much longer?
Yeah, so the next correction is comes over at 1 over m squared, and here it's a stationary phase, so it would be h over m.
But if I want to know how big the two points are, if I'm looking for some non-local interaction that you're saying I have to have. And how far apart are the points in that?
So it's a scale 1 over square root of m. But it involves h over m.
So where does the h come in?
Because of the expansion of the universe, because that sets...
No, but I just as a...
Physically, this interaction, the reason it's localized at one moment of time is because of h, because it's the light nodes have to...
I'm looking for a length, and you got h and m, and h is the answer, and m is the answer. I just want to know what the powers are. So I can think about how big it is.
You just want to know the answer.
But I thought I said the answer.
You are just saying that in a very confusing way. Because in fact, any heat kernel has a diagonal expansion. Any can start from delta function. What you are saying is a bit different statement. I'm just, as well as Cliff, I'm just trying to understand what you are saying. Because like it can't be that the
just how big is the scale? How does that distance depend on h? What's the formula for that distance?
The distance, it depends upon the co-moving momentum.
So let's say I take k to be of the order of your favorite k. So tell me what is the function of k and h and what, just.
So I can tell you when this interaction happens. So it will depend upon k1 and k2. And then I can tell you when this interaction happens, and it will depend upon K3 and K4.
Maybe I should wait. Are you going to write down one of these non-local interactions so we can look at them?
Well, I wasn't going to write anything more explicit than this, but a few slides ago, when I was explaining the stationary phase approximation, I did give an explicit formula for when the time of interaction happened. I can go back a few slides now if you'd like.
I'm just trying to get to some physical sense as to how. So, because I think it has to be wrong that there's a non-local interaction, and if all the scales you've integrated out are very, very small compared to the Hubble scale, and but to quantify what my objection is, I need to know how big the scale is we're talking about, and I'm trying to get a sense as to what it is. And
you think that it's wrong that there would be non-local interactions?
Yeah, because for instance, when you do your normalization of lambda, normally you would have been renormalizing it into the coefficients of local interactions, and so. If you're going to allow yourself non-local things, then I'm not sure how you're going to do it. What? Because then the rules don't.
Why do you have to renormalize them into local interactions?
Well, normally they do get renormalized. You can.
Normally in space-time, of course, that's true. But
and if the Hubble scale is extremely long, normally that doesn't make a difference if you're integrating with short distance stuff. And so a lot of things would have been wrong. You know, now for non-cosmological physics, if the scale is too long, and so it depends on how big the scale is. And I don't know how large it is yet.
Yeah, I don't know what other answer I can give you. It depends upon H and M.
Take an example of the thing it depends on. Give me an example of how big it would be. So you know the answer. I don't. So you can tell me. So some formula involving K and H and maybe go back to the earlier slide. I don't know.
Okay. No, I'll go back. Okay. So to evaluate this diagram, so there's one moment of time at which this interaction takes place, right? And so that time is given by this formula explicitly. So it depends upon k1, k2, and h0 and m. So that's when that interaction will take place.
So the dimensions of that thing were set by k. So you had h over m and you had a square root of 2k or something. That's something.
Yeah, an h over m and
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I mean exactly the similar situation will happen in the constant electric field in QED, but any propagator in QED in constant electric field still has an expansion.
Okay, hold, let me.
This is the same question.
How?
It's just because it can't be any kernel of an integral operator, any Green function has to start an expansion from delta function. In constant electric field, in QE, you will have similar situation, you will have similar characteristic time scale at which interaction of the moments with momenta K1 and K2 will happen. Like, suppose you have...
Okay, well, first let me just directly address this question of cliffs, and then
okay.
We can discuss this other thing later. So are we okay so far?
Well, so just 1/tau is the thing I'm thinking about, right? That's
yeah.
The scale?
Yeah.
So let's say we take k to be some long wavelength thing.
Okay. So again, these are co-moving momentum k, so it's a little hard to.
Yeah, but so in the room here, you know, we're happy to talk about momentum, and we could argue with co-moving or not, but it's momentum, we know what momentum means. So it seems like I can make that scale very large if I make the k is very small. The distance scale very large, and so there should be long locality, you know. With a small amplitude.
So first, it's not delta t. So this is the conformal time. So this actually is the time of interaction, not a difference in time. So depending on what k1, k2 are.
But as h goes to zero, that tau is getting arbitrarily long, right?
Well, it's not long. It's infinitely back in time, which is true because if k's are very small, they have low energy, so they have to go very far back in time. To be blue shifted enough to have high energy to interact with this heavy field.
So I think what you're saying here then is that the only way to get a very long distance out of it is to have a very different k1, k2, k3, and k4.
Exactly.
So if you have a very large momentum transfer. So basically basically interactions that are at low energy scales the way that you would think of low energy here in the room here, then you wouldn't have this effect very much because the momentum transfer is small. So it's part of K1, K2, and K3, K4 are very similar.
But what normally saves you from the Brandenburger disaster is the adiabatic theorem, that if things come in the adiabatic ground state, and you've made your heavy guy be in the vacuum, so it should be an adiabatic ground state, then normally it just stays there because it was adiabatic. And so I don't see why, and then from then on everything becomes local because it's the...
Because the low energy modes at some point back in time had enough energy that they could interact with...
But if they were in the adiabatic, it doesn't matter how high they were, as long as they're in the adiabatic, because then that keeps them from ever transferring their energy to anybody else. So they just, this is the magnetic field being turned off argument. The reason that you don't
Well, the second diagram is definitely not adiabatic.
But the, so then there had to be some time-dependent thing in your problem which is characterizing how non-adiabatic it was. It, normally it's something dot, you know, so it could be H or it could be phi dot or something, but so what would that be in your problem?
How non-adiabatic it is.
Normally you have to have some time dependence in the background, which is too fast, and that's what's making it not adiabatic. But you arrange the thing to be, you've got a static at chi, you've got a very slow roll for phi, so you're really, the classical fields are all very, very slow. And then the frequency you're comparing them to is m, which is very large, so it sounds all very adiabatic. And so it's kind of paradoxical that you'd see something dramatic happening.
But the cutoff is not adiabatic.
Yeah, but the cutoff isn't in any, the cutoff is not in anything if it's physical.
Right,
it's
the cutoff
is there.
If you do
the
constant
the calculation and not the other half, then it'll look like you've got big things, but then it cancels the other half.
We have these light fields, so that they have more back further time, they have more and more energy, and at some point, it's just momentarily on shell, and it can interact with this heavy field. And you're asking, what is non-adiabatic about that?
Yeah, somehow I guess the you start off with a delta function in time, and then I could see why you're getting oscillatory stuff. But then you, and then you're going to derive that, I thought, from this thing. But
exactly.
So is that coming? Is that?
Well, that's what the stationary phase approximation, the fact that this interaction is localized near one moment in time, that is the delta function. So actually, that was actually the next slide of what I was going to show you.
Well, so what chooses that time?
The K1 and K2.
It's a very de Sitter-like thing, which is very time translation invariant, so there must be some...
It is, so that slide I showed you...
Right here. Yeah, so this is the point I wanted to make. So because it is quasi-de Sitter, there is no explicit K-dependence. And so I was just showing the energy scale at which this new physics kicks in is the same. It's the same energy scale. And even the little fluctuations of the interaction are scale invariant. So it really is faithful to that.
But your statement is not that there's a relative time that's being set by your problem, but that there's an absolute time in De Sitter space that's being chosen.
The time of interaction depends upon the k. So different. Co-moving k, of course.
So it just depends on various variables, but you're saying it's an absolute time and not a relative time.
Yeah, so if I have let's say I have a k at low energy, right? Its time of interaction will be a little bit further back in time than if I started with a higher k. So it higher energy. Because it needs less time to blue shift to get at the high energy needed. The interaction scale is set by an energy scale, not a time. But when you look at the Feynman diagram and you see when these individual interactions take place, you can explicitly see.
I think maybe we should let Mark conclude.
Time is?
Oh. Right, so to touch back to something that I told you earlier, so we're naturally led to these induced, kind of localized terms in the effective action. So the second diagram, it automatically gives you this, and if you just write out the equation of motion for the light field, you get this equation which is nearly identical to a non-relativistic Schrodinger equation. And so, of course, we know how to solve this. To the left of the solution, we know it's just a free theory, and we assume that at very early times the light field is in the Bunch Davies vacuum. And then at very late times, we say that the light field could be slightly modified away from the Bunch Davies vacuum. So we're just going to allow for small modifications. And there just has to be some matching condition across this boundary. And so, so it's very simple to see what this is. And this allows you to explicitly write down the modification away from Bunch Davies in terms of these fundamental parameters. So like the coupling and the cutoff and the mass and so forth. And so this is something that people had put in by hand previously, this modification beta. But now we're actually deriving from the fundamental parameters in the theory. And of course, even though this is theoretically very interesting, it wouldn't be much good if there was no hope of observing it. But fortunately, that's not the case. So, yeah?
In this previous talk, did I understand correctly that you were putting in a cutoff dependence into your vacuum state?
You know, so what we're doing is we're
basic k. It looks like it depends on the lambda.
It does. So what's happening is that we're putting in this cutoff lambda. So it's an energy cutoff in all the interactions with the energy physics, and then we're looking at the low energy effective description. So we get some kind of effective interactions, which we normally would have even in static space time. But the new ingredient is that we also have a modification of the vacuum. So this only happens because we have an expanding background. So in the static space time, we can't have any non-bunched vacuum.
Okay.
So actually, the numerology does work out correctly, that we can, that with about 4 decades of co-moving k that we could observe from the CMB of the large-scale structure, given typical values of h over m, we actually should be able to see some of these oscillations. And note that there's kind of a sweet spot, because if you predict too many oscillations, you would never be able to discern the individual features, which is kind of average out to zero. And if you only saw like half of an oscillation, you would never think that was an oscillation. We just kind of see that as some overall correction to the power spectrum. So time kind of prevents me from saying too much more, but I should probably say a few words about the non-Gaussianity. So everything I talked about so far was really just correcting what was computing corrections to the power spectrum, or two-point correlation. Of course, the next most obvious thing to compute is the three-point correlation function, non-Gaussianity. People have known for some time that this is a very sensitive probe of theory,
because whereas the two-point correlation is really a probe of the free theory, the Gaussian part, the three-point correlation is really a probe of the interactions, which is, of course, much more interesting. And there's a very simple schematic on different types of non-Gaussianity and their physical origin. So non-Gaussianity is typically characterized by the so-called momentum triangle, because the momentum, the free momentum, has to be conserved. And so the most studied type of non-Gaussian is, of course, local interactions, which originate very well outside the horizon when the interactions have to be local. And so this is why this is usually called the squeezed type. It's also been studied these equilateral shape of triangles. So these originate from higher derivative theories, such as the DBI model. And then kind of lesser known are these so-called enfolded type of triangles. And these originate at very early times in the theory, particularly from modified vacua, as I just explained. So what we did was we actually considered theories in which we stack the deck completely in our favor. We actually considered strongly interacting theories, such as the DBI theory, but we modified their vacua. So this basically amounts to starting the theory with particles already there, so modified vacua, and then having strong interactions on top of that. So we should sort of have this multiplicative effect of non-Gaussianity. And that is indeed what we observed. So when we explicitly worked this out, we actually found there was a huge enhancement, sort of arbitrarily large, depending on the parameters in your theory. And we were able to use this non-Gaussianity to sort of put constraints on different theories. Now, one interesting feature is that the shape of the non-Gaussianity in these theories was actually previously unknown. So people had previously used these different templates corresponding to the different shapes of the non-Gaussianity. We actually found that there was a shape which really wasn't any of them. It overall had this sort of orthogonal shape of non-Gaussianity that had these oscillations. And this was not previously known. And so these oscillations actually prevented us from putting a strong bound as it should have. And so that's why the student Don Mirberg is actually working with some members of the Planck team to develop more sophisticated templates which include these oscillations. So this is something that people are going to be looking for in the very near future in the Planck data. And then finally, I just want to say a few words about CMB polarization. So in addition to having a frequency or energy scale corresponding to the temperature of the CMB photons, of course, the photons also have a polarization. And you can take whatever polarization pattern you see in the sky, and you can always uniquely decompose it into two different shapes, the so-called E and B, which are named in analogy with their electromagnetic counterparts. And this distinction is important because each has a unique physical origin. And in most models of inflation, this B shape of polarization really only originates from the tensor modes, which of course are directly proportional to the energy scale inflation. And so because there seems to be such a close connection between CMB polarization and fundamental physics, there was actually a workshop held at Fermilab about 3 years ago to see what we would learn about physics from having a polarization dedicated experiment, probably a satellite. And at this workshop, which was attended by several of you in the audience, there was actually a 100-page white paper produced, edited by Daniel Bauman and myself, and it showed the immense need for such an experiment. And in particular, we see that sort of the values involved show that there's actually a very direct relationship. If we were able to detect the B-mode component of CMB polarization, so we actually see that there's a primordial gravitational wave background, we should also be able to see these oscillations. So the magnitude of these transplanckian corrections to the power spectrum are controlled by the same scale. And so the good news is if you see one, you should be able to see the other. But the bad news is if you don't see one, you probably won't be able to see the other. So to conclude, finally, we actually have now been developing the first tools for doing effective field theory in inflating background. Besides the power spectrum oscillations, this also allows us to compute corrections to the non-Gaussianity. And then finally, this also directly correlates to things we should see in the B polarization. Thank you. Good. So as I mentioned, this is actually what we did originally because we didn't know any different. So the co-moving momentum is sort of the obvious momentum because it's conserved, and so we just simply put a cutoff. But what we found was that this actually introduces a strong scale dependence. So if you look at our early articles, we predict this this very strongly scale dependent answer. It turns out that was an artifact of this co-moving cutoff that we had used. No, we haven't done any of the renormalization stuff. But when you naively do this cutoff and co-moving momentum, what you find is that you induce a strong scale dependence. Which,
nothing, right? So you have all these, so as time progresses, you create more and more that of nothing. So I wonder whether that, then you expect someone physical. One may wonder whether this oscillation might be an artifact of this breakdown of the entire.
So I have two things to say. So one, actually, you are absolutely right that it becomes non-unitary. In fact, one of the really nice things about this Schwinger-Keldysh informalism is that you can explicitly see the imaginary parts to your action represent, you know, induced density matrix terms, so it's becoming non-unitary. You can explicitly see that first diagram, the boring result, that actually is a non-unitary correction. So it's actually, it represents kind of thermal fluctuations. So the answer is yes. Second, integrating out the high-energy physics, again, that's really what produces the modified vacuum. And it's easy to understand why. So if you have this theory with light fields and heavy fields, and then you kind of want to integrate out the heavy fields, so you pretend they're not there, it looks like the light fields are just sort of being produced out of nothing. Because it really represents the heavy fields decaying. And so that's why you're representing it as a modified vacuum. It's like an excited state for the light fields. It's already there to begin with. Mm-hmm. So the UV explanation would be they're not there to begin with. It's the heavy field decaying. But if you didn't know the heavy field was there, you would just say, oh, I'm just beginning with an excited state. So it does make sense.
Was your theory embedded in a renormalization theory?
Yes. That's why. So we purposely chose the phi squared chi.
And those cubic and quadratic terms, that must be just artifacts of the way we introduced the color.
Artifacts in that they will eventually go to zero?
Yes, there.
After the normalization, they would.
Somehow they won't appear at all if you.
Why?
The artifact of how you cut the problem up. And it's more or less along the line. But unless you have some.
If I start with UV theories.
As somebody pointed out, behind R, yeah, I can go to, I can track them by going to arbitrarily high scales. At arbitrarily high scales, nothing is happening.
That's not an issue, but what we're doing is the opposite. We're starting at high energies, and then we're integrating out the high energy stuff, and we're looking at the low energy description. And so I should find some non-renormalizable terms induced. But that's okay. If I then went to arbitrarily high energies scales, those terms should go to zero. That's true. That's why they're non-renormalizable. That's it. But we're starting with something which is renormalizable. So it is UV complete, and it's a legitimate interaction, and we're just looking at the low energy.
If lambda had a physical meaning in your expressions, I would accept that. But it seems to be just a cutoff. If you told me that lambda should be interpreted as the scale capital M, which is probably the cutoff relevant to that, then that may make sense.
Yeah, I have no other explanation because we haven't done the renormalization yet. But it does physically represent some interaction, so I can't really see how it would go to zero.
How does it slightly go to infinity? Which is where it should go. It's going to diverge.
Yeah, but isn't that normalization is our fix?
It's not consistent with what we know about the ultraviolet behavior.
I think the whole operator product expansion, I mean, I think one of the things you're saying is that should be failing in a cosmological background, which would be a surprise.
Because of this locality issue.
Yeah, because that's, I think, your claim. But the whole Schwinger-DeWitt, Gilkey-DeWitt kind of way of setting the calculation up kind of explicitly makes it local when you look at the heavy things that you're integrating out. So there's a funny thing to reconcile there. I don't really see how to do it.
Yeah, I haven't looked at that explicitly, but we just noticed that the OP worked differently in an expanding background. You get these non-local terms.
But the Schwinger-DeWitt, you can do it for an arbitrary curvature. So in particular, you can do it for De Sitter space or cosmological backgrounds. But it's very, very general, and it sets the problem up in a way which kind of emphasizes locality. So it'd be nice to compare that to this to get a sense of what's going on.
Let's thank Mark again.